This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the fifth sorta annual History of Persia holiday special 2024 for Cyrus the Great Day. Now, I am guessing most people listening at this point are familiar with how we celebrate holidays around here, but for the uninitiated, I do record a holiday special every year, but not for the same holiday. It turns out that if I tried to commemorate every holiday that intersects with the Persian Empire every time, A, that is all I would ever do, and B, I would rapidly run out of new things to say year after year. So far, we've celebrated the Zoroastrian holidays of Shaba Yalda, Nowruz, and Maragon, as well as the Jewish festival of Purim. This year, I'm branching out just a little bit to a more modern celebration. Now, I will cop to a bit of a gaffe. I really, truly thought I had posted this episode last year. Instead, 2023 became the year without a holiday special entirely by accident. I had briefly considered doing Sukkot this year instead, but we will have plenty of reason to revisit Judaism in the future. Plus, Sukkot will give me an excuse to revisit the Achaemenids again after a longer absence. I also don't want to use up all of these Zoroastrian holidays before we have any historical details about them, especially the ones tied directly to the Yezadas, because they're always fan favorites. However, we're still not that far in the narrative from the last Achaemenid King of Kings, and today gives us a great opportunity to revisit their legacy. You see, the 7th of Aban in the Iranian solar Hijri calendar, usually October 29th in the Gregorian calendar, is the unofficial but widely recognized Ruz-e-Kurash-e-Bazorg, or Cyrus the Great Day. The date is not based on the beginning of Cyrus's uprising against his Median overlord and grandfather, Astyages, in 553 BCE, nor the defeat of Astyages and foundation of a Persian empire in 550. Instead, October 29th corresponds roughly to Cyrus's conquest of Babylon in 539. Why celebrate that event in particular? It all goes back to 1971, when Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi, the last king of Iran and the last Iranian monarch to declare himself Shahanshah, King of Kings, held his 2,500-year celebration. The 2,500-year event has come up numerous times on this podcast, but in short, it was a grand festival where various international leaders, from Muammar Gaddafi to Spiro Agnew, were invited to join the Shah in commemorating 2,500 years of continuous Iranian monarchy. Of course, that's not particularly historically accurate. There are multiple breaks in native Iranian rule throughout history, and Cyrus's conquest of Babylon wasn't really the beginning of anything aside from Persian rule in southern Mesopotamia. He had conquests before that and continued conquering afterward. And the Median kingdom goes back to at least 625 BCE. But when the Shah was making his plans in the 1960s and heavily pushing his nation's ancient history in the international popular consciousness, Cyrus's conquest of Babylon was the biggest event that would coincide with a nice round number at 2,500 years, and one of the few that had a specific date attached to it, thanks to Neo-Babylonian records. It also tied very neatly into the Shah's wholly bogus story of the Cyrus Cylinder, the ancient Babylonian foundation text commemorating Cyrus's conquest as the world's first human rights decree. I don't want to beat a dead horse by continuing to bring this up every few months. That said, no, it wasn't. You can read translations yourself in many, many languages. Any reliable source will show that there really isn't anything of the sort in there, and the popular fake translation that creeps around on the internet so clearly shifts from an ancient document to a modern fake at the exact point where the Cyrus Cylinder was thought to be broken until 1970, that it would be funny if it didn't keep propagating bad history. Of course, the United Nations also continues to uphold this nonsense, so I am fighting a big uphill battle here. While I continue to think it's extremely important to combat propaganda like this that takes and just blatantly lies about ancient history, the place that that propaganda has developed in the hearts, minds, and culture of modern Iran is important and valuable in its own right. If you acknowledge that it's based on a myth, an aspiration, and a claim to a long history of good treatment of other people, whether it's a literal human rights document or not, is a good thing for a culture to have. And that's part of what I want this episode to be about. So, Mohammad Reza Shah held his celebration throughout mid-October 1971 to coincide with this event, making sure to emphasize his own place in Cyrus the Great's historical legacy. Thing is, Iran couldn't really afford the amount of grandeur put into this massive nationwide celebration at the time, and its biggest lasting impact was an unpopular event contributing to the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Given the Shah's borderline obsession with the Achaemenids, it's probably no surprise that in the years immediately following the revolution that overthrew 2,500 years of Iranian monarchy, there was an intense backlash against Iran's ancient history by the new clerical government, and the populace at large to a lesser extent. Enter Sadegh Khalkhali, a hardline cleric in the revolutionary regime, better known for overseeing the execution of thousands of Iranians who opposed the revolution, Khalkhali held a deep hatred for Iran's pre-Islamic past and the popularity it had garnered under the Shah. He wrote a whole book about the Cyrus cult, calling it a Zionist conspiracy, thanks to Cyrus's prominent place in the Jewish books of Isaiah and Ezra. In 1979, Khalkhali and his supporters led a demolition team to Persepolis, the site of the Shah's most elaborate festivities 8 years earlier. Their goal was to destroy the site in its entirety. Fortunately, they were halted on the road by ordinary Iranians opposed to this wanton conspiratorial destruction, and UNESCO stepped in to declare the ancient palace a World Heritage Site. That incident set the tone for Iran's relationship with its ancient heritage for the following decades. The Ayatollahs and other clerics in the post-revolutionary government were and are, broadly speaking, somewhere between highly critical and hostile toward their country's history before the coming of Islam. However, while understandably cautious toward the government and treading carefully around the religious implications, many ordinary Iranians continue to have an abiding cultural and nationalistic connection with antiquity, often focused on many of the same propagandistic talking points used by the last Shah in 1971. By 1991, enough of the old guard of hardline revolutionary clerics had died that things were beginning to thaw out, and the Islamic Republic president Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani visited Persepolis and faced public backlash when he simultaneously tried to use the site as an example of un-Islamic decadence and was visibly personally taken with its historical significance. The pictures and video of him at Persepolis are actually kind of shocking to see when you can see the visible look of stunned impressiveness on his face. A few years later, even Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader of the Islamic Republic, visited Persepolis. In the decades since, Khamenei has waffled between decrying Achaemenid history as, quote, a symbol of godlessness, and acknowledging it as a, quote, source of pride for the Iranian people. Then, around 2010, Iranian focus on antiquity started to shift toward Pasargadae and the tomb of Cyrus the Great. Despite what you may have heard on American right-wing talk radio at the time, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, president of the Islamic Republic from 2005 to 2013, was actually a moderate and a reformer for the Iranian government, generally lightening the religious restrictions during his tenure. This led the British Museum to loan the Cyrus Cylinder itself out to Tehran for 4 months in 2010, where Ahmadinejad publicly unveiled the clay tube and celebrated its place in Iranian history and culture, albeit still towing that line about human rights from back in the Shah's day. Iranians have been calling this date Cyrus the Great Day since at least 2006, and it's entirely plausible that the idea has been kicking around under the surface of the Islamic Republic ever since the 1970s. 6 years after the Cyrus Cylinder made its brief appearance in Iran, an informal celebration began to sprout up on the 7th of Aban at the tomb of Cyrus the Great, giving us today's holiday, Cyrus the Great Day. In 2013, an astute observer would probably have noticed the trouble brewing already. Ahmadinejad was replaced as president by Hussein Rouhani, a more conservative cleric. He did make some big promises about improving conditions for the Iranian people, and even very nearly succeeded in that stated goal by improving relations with the West before the United States 2016 presidential election upended that. Reinforced restrictions led to the inevitable public backlash, and in 2016, Cyrus the Great Day celebrations at Pasargadae erupted. First into protest against the Islamic Republic, featuring anti-cleric, pro-monarchy, and secular nationalist slogans. This was the 2016 Cyrus the Great Day revolt. For reasons that technically remain unclear internationally, police and security forces neglected to come out and help the plainclothes officers tasked with providing law enforcement during the festivities. That meant the small revolt focused on Iran's ancient history was mostly allowed to run its course with very few arrests. The thing is, modern Pasargadae is a terrible place to stage a rebellion. It's not particularly close to anything, really, so the protesters eventually had to go home. Then, in 2017, the Islamic Republic effectively shut down Pasargadae in the run-up to Cyrus the Great Day, trying to cut off any potential unrest before it could occur. For a government that claims to be revolutionary, this does show a striking failure to understand how revolutionary sentiment operates, though. It ended up being just one more grievance for the Iranian people to stack up for another 2 months before nationwide revolt broke out in late December 2017 and lasted for over a week. The Cyrus the Great Day revolt itself was small, but those actions and the targeted crackdown against the holiday the next year precipitated the largest protest movement Iran had seen in almost a decade. Since the 2017 uprising, the Islamic Republic hasn't gone a single year without similar nationwide protests breaking out, often not even whole months. Last year's uprising following the murder of Jina Amini marked the largest and most violent since at least the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s, and there are still pockets of the country where that unrest has never really settled, though they have generally been quashed by the regime. Still, it's all carrying forward the momentum of general strife that boiled to the surface on Cyrus the Great Day 2016, and we should hardly expect that momentum to stop. Additional calamities, degradations, and crimes, both from within Iran and without, have only tightened the vice pressing down on the Iranian people. And though the regime has somewhat relaxed its holiday restrictions from 2017, the specter of Cyrus the Great still looms large over any major anti-regime movement in Iran. We certainly have not seen the end of public outrage, nor Cyrus the Great's role in it. Now, normally, this is the part of the holiday special where I would explain some of the ancient history. But, come on, it's Cyrus the Great. Been there, done that. It's the first 15 episodes of this podcast. But for those of you that just want your Cyrus the Great fix now, after an ad break, I'll cut you a deal. In addition to some Cyrus content, this will be a freely accessible in the main feed version of a bonus episode that has been available to subscribers on hopfulmedia.com.co for several months now, talking about the portrayal of Cyrus the Great in European Renaissance literature. If you like it, you think it's interesting, head over to hopfulmedia.com.co and you can get access to all of my bonus episodes as well as ad-free listening and the podcast Discord server. And just to remind you what you're missing out on, ads. Believe it or not, language learning doesn't have to be difficult. You can learn naturally and speak confidently. Rosetta Stone helps you absorb a language the same way you learned your first one, through real-world context and conversation, not memorization. Practical skills you can use right away. The no memorization thing is a big plus to me. I've never been the type of person to pick up language through flipping over flashcards. Rosetta Stone is the trusted language expert with 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages offered as the go-to language learning solution. There's no English translations. You just learn to speak, listen, and think in the language you're trying to learn. It's a more intuitive learning process, starting with words, building to phrases, and progressing to sentences. Plus, if you're like me and you're trying to learn a language that uses sounds you're not used to, the built-in True Accent speech recognition feature provides real-time feedback to help you improve those pronunciations. You can also learn anytime and anywhere with a mobile app or on your desktop. And of course, as always, it is an incredible value. You can learn for life with a lifetime membership that gives you access to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want, whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. History of Persia listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. Hello, everyone. Welcome to a History of Persia supporters bonus episode, Persia and the Renaissance. I'm very excited for this one. It's actually based on a paper proposal I wrote in college, but at the time, I actually had the same professor for two classes, and she mercifully let me use the same grade for the term paper in both, so I could focus on other things at the time, which actually included launching this podcast. However, I still had the proposal floating around in a Google Drives folder, so here we are. My basic thought process was pretty simple, and something I'm surprised more people haven't written about. In premise, the European Renaissance was defined by a rediscovery and repopularization of ancient Greek and Roman literature, following the calamitous changes of the Black Death, the fall of the Byzantine Empire, and the Spanish Reconquista. In and among the many Hellenic philosophers, conquering Caesars, and long-forgotten heroes were also many tales of the Persian Empire. Surely the great minds of the Renaissance must have had some thought on that as well. Well, they did, but it often just boiled down to a comparison between them and their contemporary great Eastern foe, the Ottoman Empire and other Islamic powers, to ancient Greece and Persia. Other Renaissance writing on the Achaemenid Persians exists, but none of it is very popular, which makes it extremely difficult for primarily English-speaking people like me to track it down, and even harder to access it as most of it is not digitized. However, what I could find were a few examples from England, thanks to Dr. Jane Grogan of the University College Dublin and her aptly named book, The Persian Empire in English Renaissance Writing. So this episode will feature Queen Elizabeth I's interaction with a distinctly Achaemenid-sounding monarch, and that time Cyrus the Great was inspired by the success of Julius Caesar. Conveniently, These Persian influences on the English Renaissance also happen chronologically in order of how much time I actually want to spend on them. So, we open with a letter, and rather than explaining it, I feel like the text can just speak for itself. Elizabeth, by the grace of God, Queen of England, etc., to the right mighty and right victorious Prince, the great Sophie, Emperor of the Persians, Medes, Parthians, Hyrcans, Carmanians, Margians, of the people on this side and beyond the river Tigris, and of all men and nations between the Caspian Sea and the Gulf of Persia. Greetings, and most happy increase in all prosperity. Dated in England, in our famous city of London, the 25th day of the month of April, in the year of the creation of the world, 5523, and of the Lord and God Jesus Christ, 1561, and of our reign, the third. Even if you understood all that on a knowing what all the words are and who the names refer to level, then you probably started thinking, what in the world is this letter talking about? For anybody that needs a little bit of catch up, this is a letter from Queen Elizabeth I of England, written in 1561 CE, or AD, and also dated using the Christian Anno Mundi year, 5523, as well as the Queen's own third regnal year. It is addressed to an unnamed, or at least not obviously named, ruler of somewhere that the English Queen perceived as Persia. This letter was sent by the Queen with a trade mission led by Anthony Jenkinson of the English Muscovy Company, the first joint stock trade company granted a charter in England, making it the direct precursor to more famous ventures like the British East India Trading Company and many others. As the name implies, the Muscovy Company was primarily concerned with establishing English trade in Russia, a relatively new state at the time since Ivan IV, aka the Terrible, had just shifted from being the Grand Prince of Moscow to Tsar of all Russia in 1543. As the holders of the legal trade monopoly with Russia and the surrounding region, Anthony Jenkinson and the Muscovy Company were eager to exploit their connections in the growing Russian Empire and forge an economic connection to the East, places like Iran, India, and China, all while circumventing the Ottoman Empire. Queen Elizabeth supported them in this effort and sent a letter in an attempt to propose an alliance with the ruler of quote-unquote Persia against the Ottomans. Ultimately, Jenkinson would actually broker a tighter relationship with the Ottomans themselves on Elizabeth's behalf, as an alliance against the increasing influence of Spain and the Habsburg Holy Roman Empire. All of that was largely a side effect of the growing conflict between English Protestantism and the Catholic titans of mainland Europe. But first, Jenkinson and his queen attempted to reach out to Tomas I Safavi Shah, or in more conventional English terms, King Tomas I of the Safavid dynasty. Shah, literally just the Persian word for king, and the natural evolution of the old Persian Kashaya Thea, is a word worth remembering, by the way. The Safavids originated in the intersection of the Zagros and Caucasus Mountains under Shah Ismail I, who began his conquests with parts of Azerbaijan, but quickly expanded to rule all of Iran and much of the surrounding area, as Mulke Vasi Al-Fazeye Iran, the expansive realm of Iran, or Mamleket Iran, meaning the state of Iran. Various Safavid rulers styled themselves as Sultan, an Arabic word just meaning ruler, Shah meaning king, Padishah meaning great king, Shahriyar, friend of the cities. They were all used at different times. The name, really more of an epithet, Safavi, refers to the branch of Sufi Islam initially practiced by the dynasty's founder. However, Ismail I actually converted early on to Shia Islam, and his conquests were the event that shifted Iran to a predominantly Shiite state, in contrast to the Sunni Islam practiced in much of the Arab world, a divide which still distinguishes Iran today. However, both Jenkinson's journals and English writing about Iran in the 16th century more generally make it clear that the English, like most Europeans, were largely ignorant of all of that. Safavi was interpreted as a title, Sophie, S-O-P-H-I, clearly showing a connection to the Greek word Sophia, meaning wisdom, an important theological and philosophic concept, also the root word of philosophy itself, Greek philosophos, originally just meaning a friend of wisdom. So they interpreted Safavi as meaning something like wise king or something like that. In Queen Elizabeth's letter to her Iranian counterpart, we see not just this misunderstanding of Safavi, but also the right mighty and victorious prince, common descriptions for European monarchs. We also see the title of emperor of a long list of peoples. Of that list, only the Persians and arguably Margians were surviving extant cultural groups by the 16th century CE, and Margians only if you allow for it as an archaic description of people from Merv in modern Uzbekistan. Technically, Ismail I had ruled Merv for a few years, but after his death it was conquered away from Iran by the Khanate of Kerv, a relatively minor Central Asian state, and never reconquered by the later Safavids. Persia, while not how the people of Iran had ever described themselves as a whole, is at least understandable, as it had been the default name for the general area of Iran and the Iranians in Europe ever since the ancient Greeks had started using it during the Achaemenid period, when Iran was actually ruled by ethnic Persians. The other territories listed in Elizabeth's letter, Media, Hyrcania, Parthia, and Carmania, would have been at least as foreign a set of names to Tahmasp Shah as they were to the queen herself, as none of them had existed for over 700 years at that point. The Medes hadn't been a distinct group for more than 1500 years. Likewise, the geographic descriptions of the empire were incorrect as well. All men between the Caspian Sea and the Gulf of Persia was a slight exaggeration, and possibly more a consequence of outdated information than anything else. The area immediately south of the Caspian had been conquered by Ismail, but was also lost to the Khanate. This side, and beyond the Tigris River, was just incorrect. While modern maps of the Safavid Empire at its greatest extent do include most of modern Iraq, that region was captured by Shah Abbas I, Tahmasp's grandson, more than 60 years after Jenkinson delivered this letter. While some information about the ancient Persians was widely known at this point from their role in the Bible, the spread of Cyropaedia and Herodotus during the Renaissance, alongside other translations of the classics, provided Europe's first widely read glimpse into Iran within centuries. In her letter to the contemporary Emperor of the Persians, Queen Elizabeth I wrote what she knew about Persia, but what she knew was about 1,800 years out of date. However, listeners of this show should be pretty familiar with all of those places. They were the notable territories and peoples of the Achaemenid Empire, and that was the frame of reference that Anthony Jenkins and Queen Elizabeth were working from in the 1560s. The flourishing interest in classical literature in 16th century Europe yielded two particular texts in this regard, Xenophon's Cyropaedia and Herodotus's Histories. The first English translation of the former, by William Barker, was published in 1552, and while the first partial translation of Herodotus didn't come until 1584, a Latin translation published in 1537 and a French edition from 1553 were both in wide circulation in England. There is actually a surviving copy of Barker's translation of Cyropaedia now held by the Huntington Library in San Marino, California, which was the subject of a blog post by Jane Grogan, whose work is really the cornerstone of this whole episode. Unfortunately, the post is no longer available. The website redirects to some terribly formatted online casino website. This copy is particularly interesting, though, because it has annotations in the margins, probably from the original owner, but at least from someone early in the copy's history, given the Elizabethan language. Fortunately, I still have my notes from the first time I tried to write about this, so I can go off of that. It's a strange but insightful bit of classical reception, where we can see how a 16th century reader understood Xenophon's presentation of Cyrus. Notably, the annotator left many notes admiring Cyrus's ability to convince others to follow his orders. Grogan identifies this as one of the primary character traits that Renaissance audiences admired about Cyrus the Great in any language. However, unlike Xenophon, our 16th century reader noted some flaws, many deeply influenced by the Protestant Christianity of the time. Very ironically, for an English person, at the outset of British colonialism, the annotator criticized Cyrus's imperial ambition, pointing out that Xenophon had Cambyses I warn his son against coveting to be lords of all, accompanied by a note that Cyrus forgot this lesson. The annotator also criticizes Cyrus at the scenes where he offers sacrifices to the gods, describing it as idolatry, and kind of hysterically, as popery. Cyrus, a pagan, 550 years before Christ, who was yet to meet any Jews for most of Xenophon's story, is accused of being a papist. A full English translation of Herodotus wouldn't be printed until 1709, but 1584 saw the publication of The Famous Histories of Herodotus, translated by B.R. We do not know who B.R. was, but there are a few candidates among scholars and classicists of the time. More importantly, though, B.R. translated the first two books of the histories, meaning the part about Cyrus and Cambyses II. This translation was probably quite influential 27 years after the letter to Tahmasp Shah was written. Elizabeth I was still on the throne and considerably more powerful, but the influence of those ancient texts had only grown as they became more and more widely available in her country. As a result, one of the queen's favorite clients leaned heavily on Herodotus while writing his new work of theater. One Mr. William Shakespeare, incorporated many elements of the histories into several of his plays, but Herodotus's influence is especially visible in Titus Andronicus. Later Victorian disapproval of the play's violence greatly diminished its popularity for almost a century, and it's still one of the less popular pieces in Shakespeare's corpus. But it was incredibly well-received when it first debuted. For anybody who hasn't read or seen the play, Titus Andronicus tells a story of schemes, betrayal, murder, rape, and revenge, set against the backdrop of a fictionalized Roman Empire. If you want to avoid that, maybe skip forward 5 minutes or so. For purposes of setting and background characters, Shakespeare drew on elements from across Roman history. There's a powerful tribune of the plebs, a general returning from fighting the Goths, a triumph parade all in one scene. The story opens with a dispute between the sons of an unspecified Roman emperor, Saturninus and Bassianus, both vying for the right to succeed their father. These are real names from Roman history, but neither of the characters nor the story bear any close resemblance to real Roman events. While the brothers bicker, General Titus Andronicus returns from a war against the Goths, and Titus's brother Marcus, tribune of the plebs, announces that Titus, rather than either brother, is the people's choice for their next emperor. Behind him, Titus is bringing the Gothic captives, Queen Tamora, her 3 sons, and Tamora's lover, Aaron the Moor. Why and how a Moor from Northwest Africa is at all involved with the Goths of Eastern Europe is unimportant. That's just a Shakespearean stock character. Titus refuses the throne and collaborates with Saturninus instead, plotting to marry the Roman princeling to his daughter. There was just one hiccup. She was already betrothed to Bassianus. Disputes follow. One of Titus's sons refuses to go along with the plan. Titus kills his son. Saturninus denounces the entire Andronicus family and marries the Gothic queen in chains, Tamora, elevating her family to a high status within the empire. One day, Aaron the Moor and one of Tamora's sons were out hunting with Bassianus, and plot to kill him. Not only to elevate Saturninus to the throne, but also so that they could rape Titus's daughter, Bassianus's wife-to-be. Not only are they horrifyingly successful, but they mutilate the girl after the fact, cutting off her tongue and hands so she could not identify them to anyone else. With Aaron forging a letter to frame Titus's surviving sons for their own sister's gruesome violation. Rightly horrified, Saturninus condemns them to death while Tamora's household appears to escape punishment. However, before the sentence can be carried out, Titus begs for clemency, going so far as to cut off his own left hand and send it as a peace offering to Saturninus. But it is returned, and Titus sends one of his sons, Lucius, off to raise an army of Goths to take Rome by force and rescue his family. His daughter then takes a stick, holding it in her mouth, and writes the names of her true attackers in the dirt. Simultaneously, Tamora gives birth to a mixed-race baby, fathered by Aaron. Saturninus would be furious for her infidelity, so Tamora wanted to commit infanticide. Aaron, apparently both a monster and a mildly better parent, kills the nurse charged with this task and flees the city, only to run right into Lucius and his army of Goths. Lucius also threatens to kill the baby, forcing Aaron to reveal the whole plot up to this point. Then, things get really dark, because clearly they weren't already. Titus captures and kills both of Tamora's sons, and chops them up to cook them into a pie. What, you think Game of Thrones made that up on its own? This pie is then served to Tamora while Titus asks Saturninus if a man should kill his own daughter if she has been raped. Saturninus says fucking yes, and Titus promptly murders his own daughter, before revealing everything he knows to the Emperor, including the bit about the pie that his wife Tamora was just eating. Titus then kills Tamora, Saturninus kills Titus, Lucius kills Saturninus, and claims the empire for himself. Now Emperor Lucius arranges funerals for his murdered family and Saturninus, befitting their social status, but has Tamora's corpse thrown to the beasts and Aaron publicly hanged. Aaron refuses to repent for his crimes, so instead, Lucius orders that Aaron be buried chest deep and left to die of exposure and starvation. The end. So, maybe you can see why this isn't Shakespeare's most beloved play. But aside from some obvious ones, maybe you can't see what it has to do with Persia. Many of the events play into fairly common tropes about scheming nobles repeated with many variations in centuries between Herodotus and Shakespeare. And were it not for some very specific references, we probably wouldn't immediately identify Titus Andronicus as having direct Herodotian influence. The foreign Eastern Queen Tamora and her role in the plot to kill the Emperor is an obvious allusion to Tamiris, the queen of the Masagetae Saka and killer of Cyrus the Great, according to Herodotus. Combined with the publication of the abridged translation shortly before Titus Andronicus was first written, the whole play now gets framed in terms of the first book of the histories. Saturninus takes on the role of Astyages, the reigning king and patron of all. And his union with Tamora is a marriage of Cyrus the Great's two arch-nemeses. Aspects of Cyrus get split across all of the Andronici family members. Like Cyrus, Titus challenges the monarch. Bassianus is killed by the foreign queen, and Lucius usurps the throne. The punishments of burying someone chest deep and human pie feature prominently in Herodotus' stories of the Medes and Persians. It's hardly a one-to-one adaptation, but there is just a little bit of Achaemenid flavor mixed into one of the most famous collections of English literature. However, there is an early modern play that is almost a one-to-one adaptation of ancient literature, about Cyrus. Written 84 years after Shakespeare's Titus Andronicus, we get Cyrus the Great, or the Tragedy of Love as acted by Their Majesty's Servants by John Banks. Banks's Cyrus the Great is basically an abbreviated stage adaptation of stories from Xenophon's Cyropedia, and was directly inspired by a French novel called Artemene, which we would, for now, I'm going to avoid dealing with Artemene because it is largely written in 17th century French, which is not at all my forte. But also because it is one of the longest novels ever written. It's either one bonus episode on that, or all of Alexander the Great, in terms of podcast production. While not strictly necessary to understand how the play relates to Persia, it's worth taking a minute to appreciate John Banks in his own historical context, because a lot had happened in England between 1615 and 1699. Most importantly, on a wider scale, the rise, fall, and subsequent restoration of the Stuart dynasty, and the Glorious Revolution. When Shakespeare's famous patron, Queen Elizabeth I, died, the English throne passed to her Scottish cousins in the House of Stuart, namely King James I and VI of England and Scotland. This worked just fine for a while, but James I's grandson, King Charles I, went and upset Parliament, and the English hadn't quite worked out all the tensions left over from their religious reformation decades earlier. So they did a civil war, abolished the monarchy in favor of a de facto monarchy called the Protectorate, committed genocide in Ireland, ousted the Protectorate, restored the Stuarts. Then, there was some more debate about religion, inheriting the throne, and so on, that ended with William of Orange and his wife Mary invading England from the Netherlands and seizing the throne in the so-called Glorious Revolution. That was in 1688. John Banks was active for most of the Restoration period, with Cyrus the Great being one of his very last plays in 1699. He satirized and did commentary on a lot of recent politics, mostly under the guise of relatively recent Tudor-era settings, in his work, and he was regarded as exceptionally crude by a lot of big names in English theater at the time. The major acting companies of his day often refused or resisted performing his plays until Banks's evolving roster of royal and noble patrons basically forced the actors to do it, at which point the plays were almost universally considered very popular. Cyrus the Great was one such play, seen as lowbrow by the acting establishment, and then beloved by audiences all the same. The play leans heavily on the fictional version of Cyrus's exploits portrayed by Xenophon in Cyripedia, opening on the battlefield outside of Babylon, called the Virgin Queen in a biblically biting allusion to both Elizabeth I and the Whore of Babylon, after Cyrus defeated Croesus in Xenophon's imagined coalition of Near Eastern powers against Cyrus and his Median overlords, King Astyages and Prince Cyaxares II. As with Cyripedia, Astyages likes Cyrus a lot, and Cyaxares butts heads with him on issues of command. The play begins with the Medes arriving shortly after Cyrus's victory, and the first act focuses on a conversation between Cyaxares and the general Artabanus, known from Cyripedia as an Assyrian turncoat, who joined Cyrus. They lay out some exposition stating that the Assyrian army, because Cyripedia, is bearing down on them, and then they discuss the looming turmoil until some witches turn up. Because it's an early modern English drama, and God knows they love some weird sisters. They sort of take over the role of prophecy in the story, and in a historical context, it's easier to get the relevant part of the story and then introduce the idea of an omen sometime in the past. In a play, you either need to do a whole flashback scene or include some plot device to deliver the message in real time. Banks, and Shakespeare in the Scottish play, used the witches to do just that. As the witches fade, Hystaspes, father of Darius the Great, arrives with news from Cyrus's camp, as well as the captive Panthea, daughter of, quote, the Scythian queen. Panthea is a noble woman from Susa in Cyripedia, the only source that references her, but reframed as a connection to Tamiris here. However, as in Xenophon's version, she is still a captive brought to the Median camp, and in this version, while all the men praise her beauty, Panthea herself laments her circumstances and wishes for death. Act 2 begins with an interesting fusion of Xenophon and Herodotus, with Cyrus and Croesus together in Cyrus's camp, and Croesus calling out the name of the Athenian philosopher leader Solon, leading Cyrus to question him about Solon's history, an event pulled directly from Herodotus. This conversation ends with the introduction of a Banks original character added to the mix, Lusaria, presented here as a daughter of Croesus, offered to Cyrus as a bride and spoil of war. She's mostly there to introduce her character and act as an alternative version of the daughters of defeated kings, described in various versions of Cyrus's conquest narrative by ancient historians. Essentially, she provides the character of Amytis the Mede, while still keeping Cyrus and the Medes on the same side. You can really see how Banks is toying with the Renaissance revival of classical sources in the popular consciousness. A bit from Herodotus here, a bit from Xenophon there, but you have to choose one of the drastically different versions of events, and Cyripedia makes for the best storytelling, though the least historical. Because Cyripedia is fundamentally a storybook. Lusaria departs when Hystaspes and Panthea arrive, and once again, we are treated to Cyrus and Hystaspes fawning over the beauty of Panthea while she denies it, proclaiming herself worthless and disgraced after being taken captive. This lasts just long enough for Cyaxares to arrive for a one-on-one meeting with Cyrus, which then explains some of the backstory of the war from Cyripedia not shown in the play. Act 3 takes us to a scene of Cyaxares and Cyrus holding court when Croesus and Lusaria return, prompting them to send Hystaspes away, only for it to be revealed that Hystaspes himself is infatuated with Lusaria, even though she has now fallen in love with Cyrus. No sooner is a love triangle set up than Lusaria is roughed off stage because a Persian called Abradatus and Tamiris herself have arrived for a parley. Of course, Tamiris isn't at all part of Xenophon's story and is merely mixed into the Assyrian coalition by Banks for the play, once again merging the two most well-known versions of Cyrus the Great's history into one entertaining package for his audience. However, this council also serves to provide more build-up and exposition for Panthea's tragedy than Xenophon ever bothered with, which is understandable given that she is mostly an aside in his larger war story, while Banks is telling a love story. Tamiris came to beg for her daughter's release, and in exchange offers to withdraw from the war. However, in the course of her negotiations with Cyrus, it is revealed that Abradatus is infatuated with Panthea as well, and more importantly, she with him. Cyrus briefly leaves to consider the issue at hand, and only returns when Tamiris, Abradatus, and Panthea have all been escorted off stage by guards ordered around by Cyaxares to protect them, quote unquote. The act ends with Cyrus lamenting the circumstances of also falling in love with Panthea and finding himself the odd one out in two love triangles. Act 4 gets dramatic. Cyrus and Hystaspes agree to reconcile over Lusaria, and while all of the major male characters are working on their battle plan to face King Belshazzar of Assyria, because Cyripedia, Abradatus pulls a dagger and stabs Cyaxares, leading to the former's arrest and the Median king's slow, dramatic, dying speech. All the great tropes of tragic theater follow with an interesting mishmash of different ancient traditions mixed in for flavor. Panthea arrives just as Abradatus is being dragged away, and he bursts into a dramatic speech about, courting death and discarding all meaning in his life if only he could be with his one true love. Panthea is abhorred and shocked by both Abradatus' impending doom and his act of regicide. Losaria arrives and declares that none could stand in her way as she prepares to board a chariot carried by the north wind, an allusion to her own impending suicide. In this, Losaria takes up a variation of two different ancient stories about her father, Croesus. Herodotus ultimately settled on a version of events, as shown in this play, where Croesus becomes Cyrus's advisor. However, he also tells a story where Croesus is carried away by the winds to live forever in Hyperborea, a great mythical kingdom to the north, as well as a version where Croesus lights his own pyre and dies. In Banks's play, Losaria takes on this role, taking her own life after feeling scorned by Cyrus in favor of Panthea, who would never love the Persian king in kind. Act 5 features the battle, in so much as a 17th century play could. Abradatus, Panthea, and Thomyris fled from the Median camp and joined Belshazzar, only for both the Assyrian king and Abradatus to die in the fighting, and for Losaria's ghost to appear, chastising Cyrus for his misplaced affections. Misplaced because, in addition to not being reciprocated, Panthea follows the script laid out by Xenophon and commits suicide as well in the mourning for Abradatus. The play ends with a distraught Thomyris swearing vengeance, foreshadowing Cyrus's eventual death as told by Herodotus, and Cyrus, realizing his error, preparing to go to Babylon itself and establish his new kingdom by holding a grand funeral for Losaria. The end. It is a really interesting merger of different traditions with early modern tropes and a bit of Banks's own innovation to create a popular tragedy in its day. Unfortunately, given how poorly regarded his plays were by the theater establishment of the time, Cyrus the Great, like Titus Andronicus, has mostly fallen by the wayside in the modern world. It's a real shame, but it is one of the first explicit depictions of the Achaemenids I can find in modern historical fiction. It's also one where I think you can see the early elements of how Persian history tends to manifest in Western literature, primarily as a setting and a plot device to tell other types of stories, rather than leaning into the drama of the original historical events. And that is the most disappointing part of most of this series on historical fiction to me. Originally, I had planned to contrast this with a movie that does use the drama inherent in the original stories to great effect, partly by removing the ancient setting altogether. However, the WGA and SAG-AFTRA, the Screen Actors and Writers Guilds here in the US, have requested that online content creators not promote films from Strux Studios while the strike is ongoing. So both in solidarity and because I might want to work with the WGA
someday, information about this podcast,
I will be putting that one off for a bit.
historyofpersiapodcast.com. So instead, that's where you'll find some of my own
maps,
ideas,
my bibliography, and
until
the
then,
financial support
thank
page.
Thank you so much for
if
supporting
you just want to
the
hear
history
more
of my
of
voice,
Persia. Check out my other podcast, America Secret Wars. That's where I tell my guests about all of the forgotten and overlooked wars in American history. And if you want to support these projects or my work in general, you can head to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merchandise, or subscribe and get access to both shows with no ads, bonus episodes, Discord access, and more. No money, no problem.
The absolute best way to support indie podcasts is to recommend the show to others and leave a review. Until next time, thank you all for listening to The History of Persia.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters' 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.